Okay, good morning, everyone that's joined, and welcome to another exciting entry in our webinar series. And today we are returning to what I'd say is probably my favorite format, and that is a fireside chat. And for this fireside chat, we are going to be talking all about cloud security. And we're going to be joined by our partner, Orca Security. And Orca are very much the leaders in the cloud security market and arena. So we definitely have the right partner and right people on the webinar today. So cloud security is one of the big topics and one of the large security risks facing organizations. We've gone through that lift and shift of infrastructure up into the cloud, where we've just mirrored and replicated what we've done traditionally. And we're very much now in the era of cloud native deployments. And being cloud native, it changes our approach. It changes our way that we approach our application delivery, the way we build our applications. It changes the way our infrastructure is deployed. And obviously, it also changes and introduces new risks that we wouldn't have been exposed to previously. Obviously, many of these risks we've seen play out in public with many breaches related to exposed S3 buckets, as an example. But that's only really the tip of the iceberg, and there's plenty more that we can talk about. Thankfully, to help us, Orca have just released their 2025 State of Cloud Security Report. This is really guiding on hunting the threats and the risks in the age of relentless risks, so that we can help detect and annihilate those threats. But to help me walk through this, and very much an expert in this space, I'm joined by Bar, and I'll just introduce Bar. So Bar is Orca's security, Orca Security's head of security research. Bar Goodrey spearheads innovative research to identify and address new cloud security risks. Bar has over 13 years of experience in cybersecurity, which includes threat intelligence, malware analysis, and security research in high-stakes public and private settings. She has a bachelor's in science, bachelor's of science, should I say, in biology and computer science, quite the mix there, and is passionate about using big data to spur innovation. At Orca Security, she leads research initiatives that not only help businesses stay ahead of evolving cyber threats, but also contributes to the broader security community by sharing findings and insights. So, a true security researcher. Welcome, Bar, and it's great to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Brilliant. Well, Jot, as always, hopefully it's available on your screen, we will be running a Q&A session. So let's make sure that's actually available, marketing team. But please click the Q&A button, add questions as you go, and we will answer those in a Q&A session at the very end. I haven't moved my slides on. But just before we kick off, and I will just close this out so that we can really get into it. I think where we'll start is with a poll. So if we can launch the poll, please, Rebecca. And our poll is really looking at how would you describe your level of cloud security maturity? So are you very mature? You've got cloud security covered, it's all sewn up. And you're looking just for some extra hints and tips. Is it maturing? So are you executing your cloud security strategy and working down that path trying to get to a point of maturity? Is it immature? So are you at the start of implementing your cloud security journey and strategy? Maybe it's non-existent. John, you're at the very beginning, starting to plan your cloud security strategy, looking at how that impacts you. You may be at the start of that journey to cloud native deployments. Or lastly, what is cloud security? Which, if you're not sure, you're probably in a great place to try and get an understanding of that. So I'll just give it another 10 seconds or so for you guys to vote, and then we will look at some of the results. Brilliant. So just looking at those results there, I think probably no su surprises, Bar. We got at least one of the respondents being very mature, which is great to see. But most are either starting that journey or working as part of that journey. And it's always great to see that somebody's here to learn all about what cloud security actually means. And I don't know if that's something that you see in general, Bahar, when talking to customers and looking at the market, that we see this this level of a maturing cloud security approach.
So I meet customers every day with all stages of maturity in cloud security. You can see customers that actually have kind of shifted their assets into the cloud, and some other that are just growing into the cloud. You can see that they grow their infrastructure, and they grow their security with it. So it's a really cool journey.
Yeah, going hand in hand, side by side. So let's get into the topic and start diving down into, I guess, some of the findings of the report that we can see. And there's a hugely in-depth report which we will be sharing to all attendees afterwards, so that you've got that report to refer to. So we're not going to be able to cover absolutely every single facet and element of that report, but we're going to dive down into some of the what I'd say some of the key areas, key findings, and interesting parts that that I'm going to quiz Bar on, and hopefully add my two cents in there also. So I think the great starting point is neglected assets, and I think there's some great stats in the report around neglected assets that are there. Bar, maybe bring that to life, and really a great starting point is, what do we mean by neglected assets?
So neglected assets is any kind of asset that is severely unmaintained, unpatched. It could be almost like forgotten or neglected by purpose because we don't have time to deal with it at the moment. So we mainly look on assets that are severely unpatched, like for years, for over a year and a half, and assets that were not accessed for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah, and is it purely just assets, or we're also talking about configuration? I think that I mentioned at the start that classic S3 bucket being exposed. Do we see those as under that umbrella term of neglected assets?
So, usually, S3 buckets are not under this term. We do have a lot of S3 buckets that we see that are exposed to the internet and also contains sensitive data, which then you can definitely deduce that that's not a purposely exposed asset. Someone did it by accident because you don't want to expose sensitive data. Obviously. But under this term of neglected assets, we also see users and things like that, roles, all kind of user, all kind of cloud identities also.
Okay, I think that's quite interesting. I think identities and their roles and their level of access being forgotten. And actually, even if we relate that to the pre-cloud world, when we're looking at identity access and governance, that's a continuing problem of as people move roles, move within the organization, are they being maintained? And that's exactly the same in the cloud. And I suppose it's always the traditional corporate enterprise environment. A lot of it will be controlled through Active Directory or beyond. And I suppose there's a question about, does that apply to the cloud? Are we replicating in those roles so that management and governance is in the cloud? Or are we seeing more of the cloud being completely separated, individually managed in terms of identities? And is that putting things at risk?
So we do see sometimes mixes primarily of organizations that are moving gradually to the cloud and still have a lot of things going on premises. So we do see connections and shiftings, and we do also see incidents that are actually attackers using those connections to laterally move into the cloud from the on-premise environment. But regarding management, we do see that people are looking to manage things more centrally from the cloud because it's a little bit easier, I think. You get a little bit more visibility.
Yeah, and I'd say also a bit more granularity. I think
Yes.
that's what the cloud brings. And Joe, there's probably a whole conversation we can have around that granularity that creates that issue. Also, excellent to have granularity, but also poses a challenge of the amount of options, configurations, roles. It's well beyond the ability of human comprehension.
Yeah.
Hence, we
And
end up in this situation.
yes, also, on many cases, you have the option of like when you start a new instance in the cloud, you get a new role for free. So people are trying new things and experimenting and creating so many new roles just because they were testing something. And this is really create a very extensive attack surface. Of many neglected roles because, I created it just for the test.
Yeah, and we shouldn't stand in the way of creativity and innovation for
Yes.
people to test, but it's probably a prime example of how we end up with a neglected asset. And again, it's very classic IT just replicated into the cloud world. I think how many times in the past have we found there's just been a VM server that someone spun up for a test that's still just sat there and remains unpatched. So just going back to the cloud neglected assets. We've kind of talked about, well, actually, what are they? What do you see as the main issue? I suppose there's two parts of it. What's the issue? What's the risk? And how are they being exploited? And then separately, and I'll probably re-ask you this bit because I've broken into two. What is the challenge for organizations? Why are we getting in this position? But perhaps start with the risk and impact.
Yeah, so I think the main issue here is the visibility because when an IT team have so many assets through so many accounts and even cloud providers, it's very hard to follow. It's very hard to find all those, little VMs for testing that you've just mentioned. And so visibility is a very big part of it. But another part of it, and I think it's getting even worse every year, is the number of vulnerabilities that are being disclosed. I also have a graph of it in our slide deck. You can actually
Yeah,
see.
let me, I'll tell you what, let me throw that up now just to so we can
Yeah.
add some good context there. Because I think it is, if I can just work. So I think it is,
Yeah.
it's a great graph showing that almost continuously growing and growing significantly. So it's a great graph. Obviously, there's a drop off at the end, but I'd say that's because we're partway through the year. So,
Yeah, it's actually if you compare it to the same time last year, we're still in an increase because we still have an entire queue to go, and Q4 is always full of vulnerabilities. So we will have if you're going to do the average of 10K CVEs per quarter that we had last year, we still have 10K to go. There is an entire queue that is waiting for us in Q4. So we are in increase, and you can see also the massive increase from 2023 to 2024. It was a 38% increase. So, there's so many patching to do here, right? Because you have to deal with all those vulnerabilities. Many of them are critical or high severity. And I think that the main problem here and the reason that we see all those neglected assets is because this insane increase creates a patch debt. we're not, our security teams are not growing in the same pace as the risks. So
No, and actually, Joe, I think a lot of research shows that security spend itself is, or budget, should I say, either growing a lot less or sort of plateauing off. So, which definitely doesn't help with the argument of can we add more security bots? And actually, there's probably a whole discussion about, who do we bring in? That's the scarcity of talent is also there. And I'm sure that applies, in a big way to cloud security, because, it's although we've been using the cloud for, a significant amount of time now, there's still, that lag of, do people have that expertise when it comes to the cloud?
Yes, definitely. And I think that's exactly where AI comes in, because it can help with remediation a lot. But it also adds to the risk side of it because also attackers are using AI. So they also became much faster in exploiting these vulnerabilities. So we have like this chase of who is going to be faster here?
Well, I think we'll come on to AI a little bit later, but yeah, I think there's a good conversation there, particularly around how AI can help with the defense. I saw some very interesting stuff at DEF CON this year that I think will be great. I'll try and park that so we don't jump off down a rabbit hole on it. So just coming back to our neglected assets, I think it is a significant challenge understanding where they all are. And I think you probably hit the nail on the head when you said visibility. I think we'll always forever be striving for increased visibility. But what is the approach? So, I think as the experts and leaders in this field, I'm hoping that we've got a solution to this problem and not just a problem.
Of course. So visibility is very important because if we're talking about neglected assets, we have to know where they're at because we see that so many organizations have those neglected assets that are also are public facing. They're facing the internet. So these are those that should be treated the fastest and with the highest priority. And then we have another type of neglected assets that are not just neglected, they're also allowing lateral movement because they have some permissions, some credentials. And those things are exactly the things that we help organizations to prioritize. We'll tell them, hey, this is a neglected asset, and this is also internet facing, and also it enables lateral movement. Deal with it first. So that's what I also recommend any other organizations to do, to know what to treat first and to do the best prioritization possible when dealing with it because of the massive amount of work that needs to be done here.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I suppose that brings us on nicely to our second kind of topic that we want. So it's like we rehearsed this bar, which is really around attack paths, because you talk about the what's going to be the most exploited, what's the priority. So attack paths, I think we've seen the term banded around. Why is it important? Why should we care that about our attack paths?
So attack path is the actual path that an attacker should go through from a starting point or the initial access point, and to things that we call crown jewels, the most important assets in your environment. And that's exactly how attackers work. They look for the initial access, and then they're looking for this lateral movement into the account or between accounts. As we said, it could be even from on-prem into the cloud or vice versa. And finally, to an important asset. So why it is important? Because we have to know all the possible scenarios or all the possible paths that an attacker could be exploiting in our environment.
Well, just to sorry to jump in there, but I guess to add some context, from the Orca State of Cloud Security report, I think one of those stats in there is that 30% of organizations have a cloud asset that's responsible for creating more than 1,000 attack paths. But
Yes.
so that's 13% having that, but the worst offenders that we see that well, I say we've seen that you guys have seen is that most toxic asset creating more than 165,000 attack paths. So it is a very real challenge, and as you say, it's the daisy chaining of those vulnerabilities, of those exposures, that allows an attacker to work their way through to those crown jewels. Because I think that part of that prioritization, traditionally, when we've
Yes.
prioritized, we've looked at risk, looked at impact, but we've focused on the criticality and focused on those critical assets, which you might say, John, that's the crown jewels. Let's focus on that. But it's as important to think about the entire flow of data and the entire attack path.
Yes. Because when you eliminate those toxic assets that you've mentioned, those central nodes in the possible ways of movement in your account, you significantly reduce the possibility to have a really, really, really bad case of compromise or an entire data exposure if something happens. So we have to be aware that not only eliminating the possibility to have the initial access, but also to decrease as much as possible the probability to actually expand in our network, in our account. And this is exactly what we do when we prioritize those very central nodes. This is again something that could be really helping organizations to have more contained incidents if they
Yeah, and
happened.
that's it. I mean, working on that means we can reduce that blast radius of any single incident, so that it's contained to potentially, ideally, in an ideal world, if we're doing everything that we need to do, we won't have that incident in the first place. But I think we all know the probably the old adage now that it's when, not if, and then everything needs to be defense in depth layered. And I think this is a key part of it, is understanding that attack path, to focus on what can be breached, to limit that blast radius, to those, those front-facing, internet-facing devices, and then actually working through the entire environment. So I think that probably another thing that I think is important that we talk about, that can be a source of constant issues, and we've seen plenty of examples, but that's exposed secrets. And it's something that's touched upon in the report. So I think a great place to start, as always, is what is the risk? What are we talking about when we mean exposed secrets? Probably a little bit obvious, but I think it's good if we just address that in full. And then what is the risk, and why is it so significant?
Obviously, exposing your secrets is a bad idea, but what happens when you expose them? We did a research a few years ago and we leaked some credentials over GitHub and we waited to see what will happen. It took 2 minutes until we saw suspicious activity in the account that we've actually leaked the credentials of. And when I say suspicious activity, it's everything from reconnaissance to persistence to trying to spin up very, very expensive assets. Everything that you can dream of, it happened within 2 minutes time frame. We did it a few times because I need I need the right measurement to make sure that everything is correct, because as you mentioned, I'm a scientist. And definitely we did it repeatedly, and it took 2 minutes in average. Sometimes it took even less, but 2 minutes in average, and we saw suspicious activity done by this specific key.
I
So
mean, yeah, sorry, just to jump in there, I think, and I guess my question also to follow on from that is, how widespread is it? Because I think, what we're talking about in terms of exposed secrets is, putting credentials in clear text in something like, GitHub repository, or whether it's sharing, inadvertently sharing access tokens or whatever it is. So I think, I think, that's the clear risk. Sounds extremely obvious. And actually, probably this comes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of people spinning something up as a test, credentials reuse, or even something that moves from test into production but is still there. The people haven't done that, haven't done the due diligence to understand whether those, whether we're still using those credentials. I guess the first recommendation was don't do it in the first place. How widespread and how common and often is, the exposed secrets?
So we see, so I actually you've really got to the exact point of where organizations are missing those secrets, and where they miss their detections and the places that they oversee. So 85% of the organizations have plain text secrets in their Git repo, even if it's public or private. But the interesting part of it is that we saw many, many, many secrets in the history commits, not in the main branch, but history commits. And it goes exactly to the point of what you said. Someone did a test, the code works, and then they removed this secret and went to do the right thing of using some kind of a secret management application. But this specific secret is still alive in the Git history. And something very interesting about that is that we also checked the validity of those secrets that were exposed through the Git history. And we saw that there are more valid secrets in the Git history, because probably people really use them for a test. And going back to our experiment a few years ago, we also leaked secrets through the Git history. And we saw that we saw the same behavior. 2 minutes, the key was entirely exposed, entirely used. So this is.
And does that talk to, the constant scanning that's going on to identify them?
There is a constant scanning of GitHub,
Okay.
definitely.
And just to bring it on, so like the how do you address this? Now, obviously, the simple way to address it is don't do it in the first place. But that's not going to happen. I'm sure our developers, will want to, want to move, in the interest of trying to move quickly, will inadvertently or leave them, as you say. But on our side of the house, as defenders, what should we be doing?
So scan also the Git history, which is something that is super important, because also on local Gits, these specific credentials are looked by attackers that are looking for that. So don't forget the Git history. This is a very important thing. And if you find something in the Git history, make sure to remove it and rescan it, because removing things from Git history is super hard, and Git remembers everything. So you have to be very, very, very cautious when you work with Git and have some commit history and things like that. They're super sensitive.
Yeah, and I assume that's obviously something that the Orca can help with, is doing that identification as part of the overall cloud security posture management to allow you to react to those, and actually and remediate is the is alongside that.
We definitely we have a very extensive AppSec solution, which find those secrets in the main branch, but also in the history of the repository, and we alert on those, and you can actually stop a commit if it contains a secret with Orca. So
Okay.
it really helps you to block those things from going public.
Yeah, so really embedding yourself in that entire pipeline process to get to the root of the issue. And so it's creating that true sort of DevSecOps approach. Okay, so just I suppose moving on from exposed secrets, as I can see, time is slowly ticking away from us. And it'd be great to if we jump into what I see is probably everyone's favorite topic, or maybe it's not anymore because I think we might all becoming a little bit deaf to the noise around AI and AI insecurity. But I think it's important to talk about it. It's obviously covered in the report, as it's. Sort of talked about attackers, defenders, but I think it's, we can't not talk about it. I think it'd be good, there's no point in us having a generalized AI conversation. Really, we want to focus on, cloud security. What is the application when it comes to cloud security for AI?
So we when we look on AI or any kind of AI application, it's very similar to other applications, but with those little adjustments that are very relevant to the cloud. For example, when we talk about exposure, we see that there are many attackers that are trying to find training code or AI code to hide crypto mining applications inside of it. Because if you have a very high CPU, GPU process, you can hide there very, very efficiently. So we see that a lot. Another interesting things are around the data. Because we know that many organizations are storing their data in the cloud, which makes a perfect sense. But what happens if you train your AI models on this sensitive data? You have to be very aware of who's exposed to this data, who's using this data, who's using the model, because the entire internet is filled with so many examples of how to jailbreak the AI model to tell you things that it shouldn't tell you. So we have to be very aware of who's exposed to this data. And
Well, I think linking
we
into that is also, the securing the API calls that are going into
yes.
any platform that is given that access to any LLM on the back end overall.
Yes, definitely. And this is something that is very, we see misconfigurations of those things all the time in the cloud, related or unrelated to AI. So when we talk about this specific, very sensitive application, it's like it's three times, it could be three times worse.
Yeah, and just thinking about some of the attacker use of AI. Obviously, there's everyone talks about polymorphic malware. Being able to speed up the malware production process and development process. But one of the things that I saw a talk on relatively recently was. Abusing AI for being able to run code, that classic, white text on a white background, that no human's going to read, but inserted into part of code that's being put into an AI system. And obviously, AI doesn't question what it's being told to do, so it will follow that instruction, to the letter. So, I think there's so many risks that, particularly when we look from a development perspective, that exist that we need to defend against. But just moving on to the defense side, when it comes to cloud security, how are we, how can we use AI as part of that solution?
Oh, that's amazing. I think we also do a lot with AI to help our customers in Orca. For example, we allow a very smart remediation created by AI because it's much easier. The AI is well trained on a lot of the information, and it can really help organizations to see the exact misconfiguration, vulnerability, and the asset, and to suggest you the best remediation possible. Another thing, which is LLM, leveraging LLM to actually work with your inventory. So you mentioned that there is a lot of knowledge that is missing from security teams because it takes time to learn the entire cloud and how to work with all cloud providers. And then if you can just speak with someone to and to give you advice of where are the problems? What's the most severe problem and why? If you ask the right questions, you can actually get things very, very easily. And you can do it with MCP, for example. And we also allow actually asking questions about your inventory from our platform. So you can ask, for example, what is the worst risk in my environment? And it can actually show you the worst risk and explain why and explain what you should do.
Yeah,
So
and I think
it's an
it is
amazing
a
tool for defenders.
yeah, indeed. I mean, gone are the days where we need to learn SQL, SPL, KQL, and many
Yes.
other query languages to be able to pull out information. Obviously, we can do that sort of natural language asking. And you mentioned the use for remediation. And I promised at the start that I was going to regale people in my story from DEF CON. This year they were running a competition. I think it was $1 million grand prize for teams, building AI systems for autonomous agentic AI systems to be able to run against a certain amount of challenges to defend critical national infrastructure and other scenarios where they're getting ahead patching, detecting, remediating against attackers. And that's obviously where we're going. I think there's another chap from Anthropic using Claude AI to in capture the flags, but on the defense side, going out, patching, kicking people out of the environment. So, I think there's a huge way to go. And I'm sure that's something that we'll see getting wrapped into to platforms like Orca very soon. And actually, just one of those things, I suppose, we also need to, vibe coding is very much a thing
Oh.
these days that creates its own issues.
Yes. I actually saw a great analysis by Meta that actually showed what are the actual risks that you are likely to insert your code if you're using vibe coding without any guidance to security. So it's super interesting. It's massive amount of vulnerabilities that you just put in your code.
Yes, yeah, very, very easy. And again, that's a barrier to entry is lower, but without having the base knowledge and experience, it's very too far too easy just to incorporate code without understanding the ramifications of exactly what it's doing. So I think we're now 40 minutes in, and we try and keep these to roughly 45 minutes on. So I think what we'll do is move to the Q&A. I can see that we have some questions that have come in. And please, if you do have any further questions, please ask them. Even if we don't have time to answer them, we'll follow up afterwards with the answers to the questions. And the first question is, are there any known cases that happened because of a neglected asset? Which the answer's got to be yes, but Bar, I'll let you answer that.
Yes. So the biggest one from the past couple of years is the Midnight Blizzard. If you've heard about it's from it happened in Microsoft. So they had a neglected account. This account wasn't used for a very, very long time, and the attackers managed to brute force it. It was very low profile brute forcing and very quiet, and they just managed to guess the right password because this neglected account didn't have any MFA. So they were just managed to go in and to leverage some permissions there and to move into the Microsoft Exchange server of Microsoft. So it was a huge, 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 huge story. I really love to read their analysis of the incident. So I'm very, it's very recommended.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely something to read through. And I constantly bang on about basic cyber hygiene. And one of those things is now obviously there's plenty in terms of knowing your assets that we've talked about, knowing your sort of software inventory. But one of those basics is securing identities and MFA everywhere. So it's
MFA,
almost
definitely.
yeah. It's I mean it's I forget the I was at a talk only yesterday. There's sort of a laugh about it's just everywhere, it's ubiquitous, MFA, but actually it's not, and even Microsoft that provide the MFA solutions that many of us use are not not infallible in falling foul of such mistakes. So it's so important that we keep on top of neglected assets. It's so important that we understand the posture that we have, and then we're proactively going and resolving those. So I think it's one of the things we started with today, and I think is definitely one of those important items. So another question here, and I think we might have answered it to a certain extent, but we can maybe add a bit more detail. And that's what's the greatest benefits of AI for defenders? I think I touched upon what the aspirational part of it is. So I don't know if there's anything more to add in there, but we've probably covered it in a good way.
Yeah, I think we did. I think the main thing is helping being faster, and it's really decreased the knowledge gap, basically.
Yeah. Definitely. I think, and that's got such a much wider application for AI beyond just cloud security, and that covering that knowledge gap for security experts. Anybody in a SOC being able to very quickly they don't need to be an expert in every single protocol. They can ask a question, get the detail to make their analysis, and the same applies for cloud as well. So it's definitely that ability to cover the knowledge gap that makes means you can move faster, means we can scale and treat the threats as soon as possible. And the last question that we have in the Q&A, and as I say, we've probably got a little bit more time, we can run on for a bit if you do have any further questions. But the last question is, what is the most common risks for AI in the cloud?
So we mentioned the crypto mining, which is usually a very big thing. I saw so many cases of crypto mining in the cloud. We talked about sensitive data exposure because there's so many sensitive data that is being used for training AI models in the cloud. And another thing that we didn't talk about is data poisoning, because some of the data sets that are used for AI training in the cloud could be misconfigured. And we see a lot of misconfigurations of data storage in the cloud. If it's around buckets that are exposed to the internet, and if someone finds them, they can actually manipulate the data. They can do nasty things to the data and actually ruin the model. This goes exactly to the point that you opened the webinar with. Exposing S3 buckets can actually also affect AI models. And this is also a very known point for a risk for AI models in the cloud.
Yeah, I draw, and there has another question has just popped in just as you finished that one. If there was a common risk that Orca is almost guaranteed to find, prevent in a traditional non-AI heavy development team, what would it be as a use case to get Orca conversation kicked off with the CISO? That was a great question. So I guess in a non-AI heavy, what is the most common risk that you find to prevent?
So I think mostly around the areas of AppSec, you know, to prevent things before they go to your production. This is something that we're very, very good with, and it's very helpful because you stop the problems before they happen. This open three S3 bucket, you can actually not deploy it from the repo, which is a great solution. So this is something, and otherwise, I think we're very good with prioritization. So even if there are other type of risks, we would be able to give the right context and give the right priority according to your environment, which is, I think, one of the most important things when you have a small team to work with.
No, indeed, and it's the most basic thing really, when it comes to cloud security, is that cloud security posture management, being able to identify the the configuration. As I said before, the the amount of settings options, beyond human comprehension. So there's only really you need a platform that's going to monitor those, because one change might have a large impact. See, there's another question coming on attack paths, but I'll come to that, but it then speaks to that as well. So if there's one thing, say John, the risk they find, it is it's definitely exposed assets, exposed vulnerabilities, and particularly as generally, people are putting things in the cloud to expose to the wider internet. It's critically important that we have all of those completely closed off.
Yeah. Also, we see that highly privileged roles, service accounts, and things like that are a very big cause for creating lateral movements in the cloud. So when you adhere to the principle of least privilege, you're more likely to reduce a lot of attack paths.
No, indeed, and you've got to monitor that as well. So we just come on to the last question there. What should people be doing to reduce attack paths? Something that no one is currently doing.
So I think principle of least privilege.
Okay.
So I because we see that there's you can see it in the report, there's so many stats about how people are so far from being least privileged.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I think just what is the one thing you should be doing to reduce attack paths is actually understanding where they are, what the highest priority items are, the most critical attack paths, and working to remove that exposure as close to source as possible. So that concludes the Q&A, and if there are any further questions, drop them in, we will respond afterwards. I think just the last thing that I will do is just throw up the slide here, just to recap on what are the key recommendations that we have for our audience today. And I can talk through them if you like. So we've talked about it, and number one in the CIS critical security controls is know your assets, know your, and number two is know your software. So definitely knowing your inventory, and obviously having a tool that allows you to not only catalog it, but do that natural language searching and interrogation of that. Patch, can't say it more. Patching vulnerabilities, patching the ones that that are most critical first. And I think that very much links to the next point about breaking attack paths. Looking at you can't just look at a vulnerability by its CVSS score. You've got to look at actually its exploitability in the wild and also in your environment. We talked about disrupting those attack paths so we can't move laterally. And then the last point that you've mentioned that covers at least two of our questions is adhere to the principle of least privilege. And that has so many different aspects to it, whether it's looking at your roles, looking at your configuration, your deployments, to make sure that we're not exposing ourselves. And where, if we do have that, that the blast radius is completely reduced. So I think that is us, unless there's anything to add in there, but I think that is us for today. I think we've used 52 minutes of people's time today to dive into a great report and some of those insights. There is So much more in the report that we will be sharing after this session. So please dive into it. And if you have any questions from that, please reach out to us and we can come back to you, whether it's myself, whether it's Bar or anybody else that that we can bring to the fore to answer those questions. Before I say, before we sign off, just to call out that we have some webinars coming up next week looking at AI and data security. We have a great fireside chat around quantum computing, what the threat is, what the timeline is. So please look out for those and join, and we can have some more great discussions. So I'll say thank you, Bar, for joining me today. You've
Thank
been
you for
an
having
excellent
me. It
guest.
was such a pleasure.
We'll do it again soon. And lastly, just to
Yes.
say thank you to everybody that joined today. And hope this was insightful and useful as always. Thank you very much.
Thank you.